So you guys didn't know that I had artistic ambitions. If I were to do life over again, I would be an artist, because you can see I have talent. I have put it on display on the board today. The stick figures, in all seriousness, are my attempt to pictorially present what I'm going to talk about in the next few minutes as we start a new unit. Among the things that you should consider foundational to the Christian faith is this thing we call eschatology. Eschatology, big word that sounds pretty scary, but the word eschatology actually just means the things that are to come, or the last things. Eschatology is about what the Bible teaches about what is to come. The future, the things that will bring an end to this age of human experience. Now, when you hear the word eschatology, maybe you know enough about that word to think, oh, no. That's all that stuff that's in the Bible that's really confusing and about which lots of Christians disagree. Okay, yeah, but that's not what we're going to talk about in this class. There are things that Christians disagree about with regard to the end times, sometimes called. But those are about some of the details, some of the things with regard to the circumstances, how exactly it will unfold. I'm not going to be talking about things about which Christians disagree. I'm going to be talking about foundational issues concerning the last times. That's what I'm going to talk about when I talk about eschatology in the next few weeks. If you've got your Nicene Creed still handy, the very last couple of lines of the Nicene Creed show that this is a foundational doctrine, this particular area. The Nicene Creed ends with these words: "We look for the resurrection of the dead and the life of the world to come." I'm going to be talking about more than just those things, but that shows you that already there, in the writing of the Nicene Creed, the church is actually needing to clarify certain things about the end. I don't have any heretics for you in this unit. Nobody I'm going to introduce to you that was teaching heresy and the church needed to respond to. I will say this: from the very beginning, those who were hostile to the church and who wanted to attack Christianity from the outside made much of this area of eschatology. So, for example, they would speak rather disparagingly and skeptically of whether Jesus himself had rose from the dead, and the question of whether it's really reasonable to think that all men will one day rise from the dead. Skeptics from outside the church attacked the church fathers for some of the Christian views of eschatology. So, for example, you can imagine that Gnostics would have a problem with the final resurrection. They would have a problem with the idea that one day our souls and our bodies are going to be reunited on the day of Christ's return. We're coming to all that in just a minute. Why would a Gnostic have a problem with the doctrine of our being raised from the dead? Any ideas? Consistent with a Gnostic way of thinking? It's the same reason they had concerns about Jesus' resurrection. Addie?
Isn't it because they thought that the body was like a physical thing, and that?
Exactly. Yeah. They didn't believe in a general resurrection, a future general resurrection of all human beings, because they didn't want their body back. The Gnostics said, you know, when we die and our body and soul are separated, good riddance to the body. They had a problem with Jesus' resurrection. They also had a problem with the final resurrection. So there were all manner of ways in which not so much people, heretics within the church, But skeptics from outside the church brought attacks to Christianity about its view of the end times, the last things. And we'll have opportunity to look at some of the writings of Augustine in this area. He has to answer some of these critics, some of these skeptics about these things. Today, I want to start with what could be called the four last things. And in a sense, I am talking here about eschatology, sometimes referred to as personal eschatology. So before we're done in this unit, I'm going to be talking about cosmic eschatology, what's going to happen to the world. But today, I'm talking more personally, what's going to happen to you? What are going to be the final things you experience? And of course, I as well. And there are four last things that Christians, no matter where they are, who they are, what tradition they are, agree on if they are part of Orthodox Christianity. This is you. Unless you're female, and then that's you. Okay? Just to be clear. This is you in your ninth grade year, full of health, vigor, and mischief. This is you now. But what follows these four stages are four things that are coming for you. Things that you will experience, with the caveat, unless Jesus comes tomorrow or within your lifetime. If he doesn't, these are four things that you and I will each walk through in terms of your own personal experience. Some of it is a bit scary, but praise be to God, thanks to the gospel of Jesus Christ, none of it is ultimately frightening if we look with faith at what the Bible has told us about how God takes us through each of these four stages of the last things in his love. So what is the first?
Death.
You got it from my my picture here. That is that's a picture of the final moment of a man or a woman before he dies, she dies. So the first thing we need to talk about, the first of the four last things, is death. Let me talk about what it is, why even God's people have to experience it, and how it is that the gospel turns death into something that can be a great blessing. That is a great blessing, despite all that is hard about it. Number one, what is death? It's the first of the last things. What is it? Well, you should know that the Bible speaks of death in two ways. This is important so that we have a full understanding of this thing we're calling death. Number one way that the Bible speaks is of death in spiritual terms. And death in spiritual terms is separation from God. Actually, both kinds of death involve separation. You would do well, when you hear or think of the word death, to think of immediately separation. Things are being separated when death occurs. Things are being separated either spiritually, or the second kind of death I want to talk about is physical death. Two kinds of death, both of them involve separation. What's being separated in spiritual death? The answer to that is the person who experiences death spiritually is being separated from God. Remember when God says to Adam in the garden, "In the day that you eat of that tree," the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, "you will die." Question. Did that happen? You could say, you could do this and be right, and you could do this and be right. Why? Well, you know that Adam didn't drop dead the day that he continued to live. Well, actually, you're told how long he lived, right? It was years after the day that he ate of the forbidden fruit. Was God misleading him? Of course not. God forbid. But there is a sense, and indeed it's the most profound sense in which you can actually talk about death, that Adam immediately died. He died spiritually. And spiritual death in the Bible is when any of God's creatures, man, made in his image, intended to be in fellowship with him. God created human beings in order, intended to be sharing his life in perfect communion with him. When sin brings about a separation from God and one of his image bearers, human beings, that person is dead spiritually. Now, he may be Mr. Atlas. He may be full of physical life, but spiritually speaking, he's dead. And that's why the Apostle Paul will say in Ephesians, "You were dead in trespasses and sin." He's talking about a spiritual reality. In other words, you were separated from God, and you were separated from all hope of eternal life. You were dead. Guys, don't think that this is just some kind of metaphorical way of speaking. This is the ultimate death. I'm getting ready to talk about physical death. Nothing. Physical death is nothing compared to spiritual death. Spiritual death is the fate of all those, it's the experience of all those who do not have a saving relationship with God through Jesus Christ. They're walking, talking, dead men. They're the true living dead. They have physical life, but they're separate from God, and they have no life of the soul. That is to say, the Bible teaches they can't see, they can't understand, they can't feel, they have the insensibility of a corpse in spiritual terms. The dead person spiritually can't understand the things of God. They can't even see that there is a God. It's important for you to recognize the worst kind of death is spiritual death. The second kind of death, the death we most often think about, also involves separation. And in physical death, the things being separated are the body and the soul. When someone dies, physically speaking, there's a separation of those two parts of who he is. God made Adam body and soul. Remember, he shaped and formed Adam's body from the dust of the earth. Remember that? And then he breathed into his body the breath of life, his soul. And so all of us consist of those two parts. Sometimes Christians are confused and think about human beings as in three parts. I don't have time to talk about that just now, but I think the better way to understand how we're made is that we are body and soul. And God made us with a union between body and soul. It's quite mysterious, actually. The interrelation between the soul and the body. It's very mysterious. Christian doctors and scientists, recognizing those two realities, still can't quite explain the relationship between our soul and our body. But we all know that there's something profound that takes place when those two things are separated. It's called death. Ecclesiastes 8, verse 8. The wise man says, "No man has power to retain the spirit or power over the day of death." When someone dies, God himself has ordained the separation of that soul from that body. And as we'll see, he claims that soul and has experiences for that soul that will continue after it's separated from the body. I've taught this many years without ever having been a witness of death. But I'm teaching that this year for the first time, having been a witness of death. Attended to many people on their deathbeds as a pastor. I've visited them, I've come and gone, I've sat with them, but I didn't ever happen to be there the moment that one of my parishioners actually died. But as you know, over Christmas, my father died, and I happened to be there in the room when that took place. And there's all manner of experiences of death, to be sure. But one thing that's universal to every experience of death that can be observed is that the body without the soul is profoundly different. And it begins to be evident immediately. Now, this is not the most pleasant part of our conversation today. The second question I have might be coming to your mind. It certainly comes to many minds when someone that's loved dies, and that person who's loved, like my father, is a believer in Lord Jesus Christ and is loved by God. And the question comes, why does that have to happen? Why does death have to happen? Death in itself is something dreadful. It's not pretty. It's something that the Bible speaks of as a kind of enemy. Why does it have to happen, even to those who have been saved from their sins and who are secure in the love of God? Why do we have to go through death? Well, folks, the answer begins with the reality that death is God's judgment upon all mankind for sin. We who have put our faith in Christ have been spared his eternal judgment. Praise be to God. But we still experience in this life many of those temporal judgments. That term simply means the judgments that come in time. So you stub your toe. You break your leg. You get sick. COVID or otherwise. These are consequences of sin. They wouldn't be part of the world except that sin entered the world. Thank you, Adam. And these are temporal judgments, and it has been God's good pleasure, I'll say it, it's been his sovereign will that all mankind experience death as part of the temporal consequences of sin. Psalm 90 is about that. Psalm 90 is written by Moses. And among other things, Moses says, "We are brought to an end by your anger." By that he means it's not as if when a saint dies, God is angry with that saint. That's not what Moses is saying. But I think what he is saying is the fact of death is something all of us experience because God in heaven is angry at sin and has not lifted all the consequences of sin, even from those who are his redeemed. So death is judgment for sin that all of us partake of. But here's the good news, and this is the third thing that I really want to emphasize. Death for the child of God, though it in itself is an enemy, in itself is a part of the judgment of God for sin, it has been turned by the gospel into a path towards unspeakable blessing. If you will, death becomes a doorway for God's people into the very presence of God and the blessing of God. This is why Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, after talking about the resurrection and all that is going to come on the other end of death, he says, "Oh, death, where is your victory? Oh, grave, where is your sting?" And since I've mentioned it, I'll tell you that I experienced that hope and that confidence and even that joy in that same experience that I shared with you about watching my own dad die. I have been mainly citing the Nicene Creed in this class because it's what focuses on the foundational doctrine of faith. But I want to read to you now from the Westminster Larger Catechism. That's a Presbyterian creed now, much longer than the Nicene Creed. And I think I have referenced it in this class. And in case you think that creeds and confessions are dry and dusty and they're just there to keep us from being heretics, listen to how comforting this word is. This is taken from Westminster Larger Catechism 85. It's responding to the question, why do God's people have to die if he loves them and if he saved them from their sins? The answer is, the righteous shall be delivered from death itself at the last day. That is to say, though they die, they'll be delivered ultimately from death. It's talking about the resurrection. And even in death, the righteous are delivered from the sting and curse of it, so that although they die, yet it is out of God's love to free them perfectly from sin and misery, and to make them capable of further communion with Christ in glory, which they then enter upon. Then the Catechism talks about what that communion is like. What is it that happens this very moment of death? And you see what I've drawn here? I'm getting into the second of the last things here, but this is my attempt to capture that there's a separation that takes place in death. This is my picture of a soul, in case you weren't sure. How do you like my soul? All right, that's my soul. And that's my body in a casket in the ground. Body and soul separated the very moment of death. But what the Catechism is saying is that this moment of death, though it may involve pain, it may involve great trial, it may take a long time, a short time, the moment of death becomes the moment when this soul goes directly into the presence of God. I'll read from question 86. What is this communion with Christ in glory? that was just referenced in the previous question. The communion and glory with Christ, which the members of the invisible church enjoy immediately after death, is that their souls are then made perfect in holiness and they're received into the highest heavens. Okay, that's not very high on my drawing, but you get the picture. They're received into the highest heavens where they behold the face of God in light and glory, waiting for the full redemption of their bodies, which even in death continue united to Christ, and rest in their graves as in their beds, till at the last day they be again united to their souls. Catechism has been stealing some of my thunder because it's talking about this stage and this stage, which you've already guessed, I think, what it is. Death is the first of the last things that every one of us, if Christ delays, will experience. Talked about what death is, why it has to happen, and how the gospel turns it into something that brings great good. Now let's talk about this second stage. And this is something I want you to listen carefully to, because I think a lot of Christians are confused about this second of the four last things. This is a period of time, could be days or years, or for some, it's been thousands of years, in which their souls and their bodies have been separated. Can you think of anybody who has experienced this separation of body and soul for thousands of years? Can you think of anybody? You ought to be able to think of a lot of people. Like Adam, right? Like Abraham. Now, we theologians and Bible students don't have a very great term, in my judgment, for this second of the last things. They talk about it as the phase of time between these two times. This is death. What is it? I'm drawing this. What am I drawing here? You know this, right? What is this? What's phase three? My drawing should make it perfectly clear.
Soul and body.
Yes. What is that called? Yep. It's on the sign out front. Yes. Okay. So this is resurrection. Phase three is the resurrection, which is a body coming from the ground, newly made or remade, and the soul, and they're being reunited. So that's me on resurrection day. See all the sparkly? I get a new body, and my soul is reunited. It's resurrection is the undoing of death. It's the reversing of death. It's death in reverse. Death was a separation of body and soul. Resurrection is a reuniting of body and soul. Okay, I got ahead of myself. Hold those thoughts about resurrection. What do we call this? All right, are you ready for a really... We need to have a new name. Make a contest for a new name. But here's the name that theologians call this phase. Oh, boy. Pretty humdrum, isn't it? They call it the intermediate state. I'll tell you in a moment some of the terms that the Bible gives to it, which is better, of course. But this is called the intermediate state. And I do want you to know that term, because many Christians are confused about this season of time in which body and soul are separated. I can go to a place in Virginia where my dad's body lies in the ground. But my great comfort and joy is that his soul has gone to be in heaven with the Lord Jesus, and notice, with the souls of all those who have died beloved of God. Guys, that's a lot of souls in heaven right now with my dad and those who you love who have already died in the Lord. The intermediate state. I want you to turn to Luke chapter 16 now. And we will see a parable. I do think it's a parable. I don't think it's a literal story. There's some discussion about that. It's the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. And this parable does a number of things to help us with the last things, but it certainly gives us some clear information about this intermediate state. Luke 16, I'm going to begin reading at verse 19. There was a rich man who was clothed in purple. By the way, Jesus is talking, in case it's not clear. There was a rich man who was clothed in purple and fine linen and who feasted sumptuously every day. And at his gate was laid a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who desired to be fed with what fell from the rich man's table. Moreover, even the dogs came and licked his sores. The poor man died and was carried by the angels to Abraham's side. You know someone who died knowing and loving Jesus. That's a description of what took place immediately, the moment of death. The rich man also died and was buried, and in Hades, being in torment, he lifted up his eyes and saw Abraham far off and Lazarus at his side. And he called out, "Father Abraham, have mercy on me, and send Lazarus to dip the end of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am in anguish in this flame." But Abraham said, "Child, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, and Lazarus in like manner bad things. But now he is comforted here, and you are in anguish. And besides all this, between us and you, a great chasm has been fixed, in order that those who would pass from here to you may not be able, and none may cross from there to us." The story continues. I'll stop right there. Folks, there are any number of people, not in the Christian tradition, who believe that there is one, not four, last things. In other words, death is the end. And of course, that's not Christian orthodoxy. No Christian believes that death is the only one of the last things. What we'll look at is that there are four things that can be said about this time when the body and soul are separate. Number one, it is a place of conscious existence. That is to say, Lazarus and the rich man after death are aware of their circumstances. They're conscious. I don't think, by the way, that this is a story, a literal story, because not every point of it can be pressed literally. So, for example, the rich man can't have a literal tongue and have his body buried, and both are said in the parable. I don't think the story is intended to be pressed at every point. But one of the things that's very clear that the whole story depends on for teaching us about what comes after death is that both men are conscious. They're aware of their surroundings. They're even capable of communicating. So this is important to say. This is one mode of existence. This is another mode of existence. This is you and me with body and soul united. But guys, it is possible to exist, to be conscious, to be aware when all you've got is a soul. By the way, you know this thinking that when you die, you become an angel? Come on, guys. You know, that's what Hollywood says, right? It's a wonderful life. That's what happens when you die. You become an angel. Well, that's not true. There's people, human beings, and there's angels, and they don't ever become the other. Okay? That's not in the Bible. No one ever gets to become an angel. But, do you see how people could sort of mash up biblical teaching and say, well, I'm a soul when I die. I'm in heaven with all the other angels. Angels are spirit beings that don't have bodies, unless they want to have them, apparently, because sometimes they appear in bodily form. But so angels are spirit beings without bodies. That's what I'll be, so I'll be an angel. You can see how people would get confused about that, right? In the intermediate state, we're in a state of spiritual conscious existence. Here's a side note. Have you ever heard of Seventh-day Adventists? Seventh-day Adventists are part of the Christian tradition. They have a number of distinctive doctrines. One of their doctrines is the doctrine of soul sleep. And at various times in the church, people have advanced this idea that what happens at this moment, say that's Adam on his deathbed. When Adam died, his soul went someplace, but it lost all conscious experience. It's like the soul went to sleep. And the way that this idea goes is that the moment you die, you'll be at the resurrection in terms of your conscious experience. It'll be like, have you ever had a really, really, really good sleep where you fell asleep and then the next second it felt like you woke up and it was 8 hours later? I haven't had that kind of sleep in a long time. But I have had an experience where the soul has no sense of the passing of time. Some people have suggested that that's what happens at death. But Luke 16, this whole story makes clear that there's conscious existence after the after death. That's number one. Number two, about the intermediate state. For unbelievers, the intermediate state is a place of torment. I say that very soberly. For unbelievers, the intermediate state is a place of torment. The whole story that Jesus tells is of the rich man who had a great life here, but he is in torment. His soul doesn't go there, it goes somewhere down here, at least pictorially. I have in mind a believer when I get to take us through this. But the soul and the body are separated in the case of an unbeliever, and that soul does not go into the presence of God. It goes to a place of torment. Rich man says, I'm in anguish, verse 24. Abraham says, now you are in anguish, verse 25. Verse 28 repeats that theme. Why is this? Well, brothers and sisters, this isn't hell, but it is the foretaste of hell for those who die without a saving relationship with Jesus. 2 Peter 2, verse 9. The Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials and to keep the unrighteous under punishment until the day of judgment. And Jesus is speaking of the rich man there in a place of torment until the day of judgment, which is when the reality of hell and all of its dreadfulness will be their experience. We'll come back to the doctrine of hell. So the intermediate state is like the soul going of the damned, the souls of those who are unbelievers, going to a kind of a place of torment of prison. This is the teaching of the Bible. Third thing, though, happily, is that it is a place of great comfort for believers. That's what we're told about Lazarus. Lazarus, poor and without comfort in this life, and he goes to, this is where you get the expression, the bosom of Abraham, an expression of intimacy and enjoyment of fellowship with the greatest of all the saints of the Old Testament, Abraham. You guys know the soul, rock of my soul, in the bosom of Abraham. It's a reference to this place where Lazarus goes. He's reunited with the great people of the of God from the past. He actually gets to be with Abraham in his wait. Both are waiting. It's an intermediate state, by the way. That's what both are waiting for this. One is waiting there with the comfort of the presence of God. And the other is waiting in another place without the presence of God and with punishment. Remember when Jesus says to the man hanging on the cross next to him, "Today, you will be with me in paradise." Where was the body of Jesus going to go that day? He's going to go into a tomb. Where was the body of that thief going to go? It was going to go probably some mass grave. It was not going someplace nice. But it was also going to a grave. But they would both, Jesus and the thief, their souls would go to be with God. And what Jesus is saying to the thief is an assurance that he's been saved. That's why Paul can say in 2 Corinthians 5, verse 8, "We are of a good courage. We would rather be away from the body." That's the intermediate state Paul's talking about. "We would rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord." In other words, Paul said, this is good. This is better. Not because I don't like my body and I'm a Gnostic. But this is better because even though I'm separated from my body, my soul gets to be with the Lord. So that's how great a place it is. A place of comfort. One other thing I want you to know about the intermediate state. And somebody's going to come up with a better name for it, right? Caleb, you got that? Can you give me a better name than the intermediate state? Something flashy. Something memorable. Work on that over the break, okay? Fourth thing I want you to know is that it is a place of the perfection of the souls of believers. If this man's soul is among the damned and goes to a place of torment like the rich man, that soul only gets more sinful by the day there. But if that soul is the soul of the redeemed and goes into the place where God dwells, guess what? There's no sin in heaven. And that means that God wonderfully and graciously perfects the souls of his people at their death. The souls of believers are at their death made perfect in righteousness and do immediately pass into glory, the catechism says. But their bodies, being still united to Christ, do rest in the grave until the resurrection. A little more catechism for free. What this means is that that bed, like all of the rest of life, has been a place where the soul has been sinful. The soul has, even the soul that's redeemed, it's sinful in all that it does. But the moment of death brings a transformation of the soul of the redeemed. Hebrews 12, verse 23, speaks of this. speaks of the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect. So this is part of why Paul says, death, where's your victory? Okay, death is still able to bring a separation from body and soul, but two wonderful realities for the believer. Not only does the soul go to a place of comfort, but the soul goes there in perfection. All sin is removed. All the things that grieve us in this life about ourselves, all the petty and terrible, for that matter, sins of our souls are removed by God. We are perfected the moment of death. This is something we can only imagine, guys. What would it be like to think and to feel and to act without any sin? But you just got to use your imagination. Because we don't have a category for it, do we? And that will be your first experience. That'll be your first experience of sinlessness. The intermediate state is called that by theologians. But you should know that the scripture sometimes uses the word Sheol to refer to the intermediate state, Sheol. The prayer of Hannah in 1 Samuel 2:6. The Lord kills and brings to life. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. Another word the New Testament uses, sometimes in a way that would be synonymous with the intermediate state, is the word Hades. Now, sometimes, there are differing uses of the word Hades, but sometimes the New Testament will use the word Hades to refer to where everybody goes when they die. It's the realm of the dead. It's a catch-all. It's a reference to where it's that state of existence apart from your body. So Revelation 20, verse 13 is an example. The sea gave up the dead who were in it. Death and Hades gave up the dead who were in them, and they were judged, each one of them, according to what they had done. That's referring to the righteous and the wicked. Sometimes it's confusing to people. I'm not sure that Sheol and Hades, I think that's why they haven't become the primary way we describe it. I remember the passage in Luke where I mentioned Luke 23, Jesus says to the thief on the cross, "You will be with me in paradise." Paradise seems to be the word used to refer to that place which isn't heaven in all of its glory, but it's a foretaste of heaven. That's what those who die in the Lord begin to enjoy. Intermediate state. That's the second of the four last things. Let's talk about the third. To talk about the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I want you to turn to 1 Thessalonians. Sorry, not the resurrection of Jesus Christ, the resurrection by Jesus Christ of all men. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. For one of the best New Testament passages to refer to this third of the last things. By the way, I'm pressing on for the sake of time, but I will ask, do you have any questions about what I've been saying about the intermediate state? I'll give you a little hint. Some people think of the intermediate, a hint of the confusion I'm going to come back to. Some people think of the intermediate state as just the same thing as heaven. And there's some confusion that arises there, because what the Bible teaches is that there's coming a time when we will be in the new heavens and the new earth with resurrected bodies and Jesus physically present among us. Well, that ain't this. This is good. That which is coming is even better. New heavens and new earth. Let's talk about how we get our bodies back. That's the doctrine of the resurrection. 1 Thessalonians 4, I want to see four things about the resurrection from this passage. And I'll throw in one other right at the end. Look at verse 15 of 1 Thessalonians 4. For this we declare to you by a word from the Lord, that we who are alive, who are left until the coming of the Lord, that's talking about Jesus, will not precede those who have fallen asleep. That's a reference to death. Be thinking in the back of your minds as I keep reading, why would people in the Bible call death just falling asleep? We'll come back to that in just a minute. They will not precede those who fall asleep. Four, verse 16. The Lord himself will descend from heaven with a cry of command, with the voice of an archangel, and with the sound of the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. So number one, that you need to know about the resurrection. It will take place at Jesus' return to earth. You put together in your minds, get this down deep into your DNA, the resurrection happens when Jesus comes back. The return of Christ and the resurrection of the dead go together. And the reason they go together is that the resurrection is going to be something that Jesus himself brings about. Jesus, we're told, is going to come with a cry of command. Guys, do you remember the last time Jesus did this? He commanded a dead guy to come from the dead. Who was that? Interestingly.
Lazarus.
Another guy named Lazarus. An actual guy. His friend, Lazarus. Remember what he did? He stood outside the tomb. Lazarus is dead and stinky. He'd been dead that long enough. And Jesus stood outside his tomb and said, Lazarus, come here. And the dead man obeyed. On the last day, Jesus is going to do that times many billions. And he is, by the power of his divine command, going to say to everyone who's dead, come here. We'll see in a moment that he's calling them to judgment. That's going to be number four, judgment day. But when Jesus comes and commands the dead, his command is what we call an effectual call or command. He can make happen what he commands. Better than any Jedi. You know, the Jedi can and can exert his will on other things. That's fun Hollywood stuff. Remember when God created the whole world in Genesis? How did he do it? He just said, let there be light. That's how strong he is. He doesn't have to do this kind of thing. He just speaks. And Jesus will come and he will speak the dead into life. So it takes place at the return of Jesus to the earth. So that's not part of my drawing, is it?
I just have you coming back together. But this is taking place as Jesus comes back to earth.
Number two, the resurrection involves a return to earth of the souls of the dead. Guys, in order for there to be a general resurrection where the bodies of everybody from Adam to Hugh Hefner, a wicked man who just recently died, come back to life, in order for that to happen, the souls, wherever they are, in the place of torment or in the place of comfort, have to be restored to them in this world, in this on this terra firma, the planet. So I don't know if you've ever thought about it this way, but when Jesus returns, he will come with the souls of all of his people who have been there with God in the place of paradise. Paul talks about that in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verse 14. Since we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so, through Jesus, God will bring with him those who have fallen asleep. And in the context when Paul says this, he's writing to people, the Thessalonians, who have shown themselves to be concerned. My grandmom, put her faith in Jesus, but then she died. What's going to happen to her? She isn't here for the return of Christ. And Paul says, let me clear something up. Those who've died, who've already gone to be with Christ, not only do they participate in the resurrection, they get in on it first. Because the resurrection comes about by Jesus returning to earth. Guess who knows he's coming back to earth first? Those souls that are with him. They're actually going to come with him to the earth. Grandma's going to get first place. She's going to have the front row to the whole thing. Here's a fun thought. For most of mankind, the resurrection is something that's awaited from heaven or from the place beyond the grave. This is what the souls of God's people are doing. They're looking forward to this. They're longing for the day of resurrection, when they'll be reunited to their bodies. Which brings us to number three. The resurrection involves a recreation of the bodies of the dead. You just think about this for a moment, and it will boggle the mind. I mentioned that Jesus calling Lazarus from the tomb is what he's going to do in the last day times billions. But it's even better than that. It's even more amazing than that. Because Lazarus' body, though it was beginning to decay, was all right there, it was all lying in the tomb, right? Where is Jeremiah the prophet's body right now? Anybody know? Where is Jezebel lying buried? You don't know? How about Sarah? We're told where she's buried, right? Can you still go to Sarah's tomb? Her body's still there? My point, of course, in this is, with the passing of time, guys, our bodies, just give it enough time, our bodies completely, totally disintegrate. There's all kinds of ingenious ways to preserve the body, at least the bones of the body. All kinds of ingenious ways to do that. But given enough time, our bodies return to dust. That's what happens. And if you wanted to press that even further, they are assimilated back into the natural world, aren't they? So it's even more than just Jesus saying to a corpse that's lying there, come here. It's Jesus saying to billions of people whose bodies have completely disintegrated and returned to dust, stand up. So guys, the glory and the mystery of this moment, what we believe, get this, what Christians actually believe about the final resurrection is that what God did in the garden by taking dirt and forming Adam from that dirt, you know, just one at a time, he just did Adam. When he formed Adam from the dust of the ground, that's what Jesus, in his command to all men to be raised, that's what he's going to be doing. He's going to be taking bodies from the ground and reforming them, us, from the dust of the ground. And if you think it's pretty amazing that God did that once with Adam, you're going to be really amazed when he does it times billions on the last day. The original creation of man involved God gathering together nothing more than dust. And that's what's going to happen on the day of resurrection for most of humanity. It'll be just dust. The original creation in the garden of man involved God imparting to Adam a living soul. The recreation that's going to come on the day of resurrection is not a new soul, but the rejoining to each one of those newly formed bodies from the dust of the ground, the soul that has been in one of those two places, in the intermediate state. And just as God accomplished that with his spoken word, he will accomplish it yet again by his word. Folks, it's important to know that everybody who has ever lived will be resurrected. Everybody. The Bible has a lot more to say about the resurrection of the saints. Because, well, it's obvious the Bible is written to the saints and it's about their experience. And so this is the experience of God's people. But it's important to know that everyone will be raised from the dead. That will not be good for the wicked. You know why? Jesus tells us they'll be thrown body and soul into hell. Coming to that in a couple of weeks. The wicked will be raised. Their bodies and souls will be reunited so that they as whole persons can be punished in hell. The righteous in Christ will be raised, their bodies and souls reunited, in order that they can body and soul spend the rest of eternity with Jesus and one another in a real physical new heavens and new earth. We'll talk about that as well. But number four of the resurrection is that it will involve a transformation of both the bodies and the souls of those who are alive when Jesus comes. I know that's a lot. Let me say it again. The resurrection will involve a transformation of the bodies and souls of those who are alive when Jesus returns. Okay, follow me there here. When Jesus comes back, some people are actually going to be alive. You know that. Some people, you may hope that you're among them. I do. That'd be wonderful. Will never die. you'll never die. If you're alive when Jesus returns, you won't die. You'll escape death. This was a great joy to think about. But here's the question. If this person's soul has been made sinless, perfect, righteous at the moment of death, and this person's body has been renewed and made perfect in the moment of resurrection, well, what about that sorry bloke who's just alive when Jesus comes back? Is he stuck with his sinful soul and his bummer body? I mean, you guys are beautiful, but your bodies aren't perfect. Does he miss out? He doesn't have a dead body being perfectly remade, and he doesn't have a soul that's been separated from his body and has been in heaven all this time, already sinless. What happens for the person who's alive when Jesus comes back? And the apostle answers that in another passage. Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Folks, it's no ordinary body. It's no body like anything you and I have experienced that can endure hell forever and ever. And it's no ordinary body, no body like you and I've experienced, that can endure eternity in heaven, the new heavens and new earth. We need better bodies, a more durable, at least, bodies for either heaven or hell. And God is going to provide for that. Not only for those who die and then are raised from the dead, he's going to provide for that for those who are alive when Jesus returns and brings about the resurrection. So, 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 51. Paul says, "Behold, I tell you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed." Are you listening? Falling asleep, of course, means death. By the way, why does the New Testament talk this way? Remember when Stephen is being stoned to death in the book of Acts? He's dying a violent death. And then Luke, recording this, says, "And then he fell asleep." Is that because Luke's just squeamish? He doesn't want to use the word death? We know that that's what happened to him. He died. Owen?
In 5, there's going to be an awakening.
Yeah, it's a beautiful picture. This man who's just died is a little bit like a man who's just gone down for a nap. You or someone you love go down for a nap. They're still, in some cases, they're breathing so quietly, you have to listen, see if they're still breathing. And then they wake up. They get up and they start going back to what they were doing, right? That's the nature of sleep. And the Bible talks about believers being asleep in the grave. Not because they're squeamish about death. They know a thing or two about death, the New Testament writers. But it's an expression of faith and hope. They're lying still right now. They're going to be back in business the day of resurrection. That's the piece about sleep. Back to our text, 1 Corinthians 15. We shall not all sleep. Some of us aren't even going to sleep or die. We shall all be changed. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet, 4, the trumpet will sound and the dead will be raised imperishable. That's a reference to the new bodies that they're going to have. Their new bodies are going to be imperishable, unlike their old bodies. And this mortal body must put on immortality. Here's the bottom line, guys. Follow me on this. If you're this person who goes through the experience of death and the intermediate state, you will experience the transformation that makes you ready for heaven in 2 stages. First, your soul will be made perfect, and then at the resurrection, your body will be made perfect. You got that? That's the experience of most of God's people. Their soul at death is made perfect,
Their body is made perfect at the resurrection. But if you're alive when Jesus comes, you'll be made perfect in one stage, all at once. Body and soul, you'll be changed. What will that feel like? I have no idea. What will that look like? I have no idea. I have to use my imagination. I will suddenly become good looking and strong and young. And I have no idea. But my body will be changed if I'm alive when Christ returns, and my soul will be made perfect in righteousness. And by that, I will be made ready for heaven, an eternity of being with God, just like my dad. Soul is sinless now. Body one day to be transformed, reunited with the soul. These things are important to say about the resurrection in light of the fact that we will not all be raised from the dead. Some of us will not even die. But everybody will be perfected who is a believer in the Lord Jesus Christ. So the last of the four things, which I must come back to on at the end of, or the other side of break, is the final judgment. That was pretty obvious, right? That's a crown. Everybody knows that's a crown, right? Could you see that back there? It's Jesus on his throne. And this is the resurrected human being. Whether of the saints of God or the men of this world. He's resurrected. He's standing before Jesus. And when we come back, other side of break, we will talk about the final judgment. It's the fourth of the last things. You have no homework. I hope you don't mind. Look forward to seeing you on the 19th. You're dismissed.